Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the worst podcast on the internet. I am, as always, your host, Josiah Hawkins. And there have been no movies that have actually come out recently. So I guess we're just, my plan anyway for this episode was just to continue talking about the movies that I own, why I own them, why you should watch them if you haven't already, that kind of deal. Like I said, people seem to, people seem to really enjoy that. Oh, geez. So hopefully, now that we're in, like, episode 4 of me doing this, only the second episode, though, where I've exclusively done this. Hopefully you guys aren't getting tired of it or anything, because obviously we wouldn't want to do that. Some new movies that I have since bought, since then, have been movies that I've talked about already this year, as far as, you know, them coming out and my opinions of them. And those were just sort of here in alphabetical order: Alien Covenant, Free Fire, Ghost in the Shell, let's see here, King Arthur, Life, and I think there was another one? Oh, and then I picked up The Young Pope, the HBO series, because that series was just incredible. But yeah, those are all movies that I, other than really The Young Pope, which I could probably talk about for a whole episode, but outside of that, you know, all those are movies that we've reviewed this year. And they're all really good. I mean, if you haven't seen, if you haven't seen King Arthur or Ghost in the Shell or Free Fire or Alien Covenant, they're all real good movies. And then I also picked up a 4K transfer of Dread, which is a great movie. Especially if you're into the character of Judge Dredd. It actually does the character from the comic books justice, as opposed to the relative abomination that was the Sylvester Stallone movie. Outside of the action in the Sylvester Stallone movie is pretty good, but like the Sylvester Stallone and the story is just it's real bad. Oh yeah, that weird crinkling noise is I am attempting to drink a frozen soda. That I had to freeze because it dropped on the ground and part of the can, like, opened up and it was fizzing everywhere, and the only way to get it to stop was to freeze it. So that's what that is. Sorry about the crackling noise. I realize that's probably pretty close to the mic. But the next movie here on my shelf is a movie called Moon, which is a harder movie to actually find. This movie was one that really, really flew underneath the radar. I believe that it was released in 2009. And it's, you know, if you know who Sam Rockwell is, you know that Sam Rockwell is a great actor. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a bad performance from Sam Rockwell. He has a lot of range as well as far as what he can do. He can be funny, he can be tragic, he can be dramatic. You know, he can really do everything. And oftentimes in a movie where the movie itself is bad, Sam Rockwell is sort of the best aspect of the movie. But in this case, he is not just the best part of the movie, but he's the best part of a great movie. I'm a big fan of sci-fi, and there's a lot of really good underrated sci-fi movies, and this is certainly one of them. And it's really only underrated by the virtue of the fact that, like, very few people have actually seen it. When it came out, you know, I don't really think that it had a very large advertising budget. I don't even know if it was even a wide release movie. I think it was a limited release movie. But it's Duncan Jones' first movie, and if you don't know who Duncan Jones is from Moon, then you would probably know Duncan Jones from Warcraft, which was the World of Warcraft movie. That was his third movie. It came out last year, I believe, either that or 2015, but I'm pretty sure it was a 2016 movie. And then he also directed the excellent Jake Gyllenhaal movie Source Code, which I quite like. It's pretty clear to me that Duncan Jones is a director who has a very high degree of interest in cerebral sci-fi, which in a lot of ways is a underutilized genre. I think that a lot of sci-fi nowadays is sort of just genre movies, really. You know, the tropes are there. They're not really going for anything, you know, too outside the norm, anything too new or too interesting. Moon is a movie that certainly has some plot points that have been done before, you know, as far as with cloning and things like that. But to the story that they were trying to tell, I don't think that it's really been done before. You know, I think that science fiction can be an extremely cerebral experience. I think it can be an extremely smart genre. And movies like Ghost in the Shell this year, which had a lot to do with human identity, and Moon, are both two movies that can really execute that sort of genre well, that cerebral sci-fi genre. So, moving on, I've got Mr. Robot season one. Mr. Robot is the best TV show on TV, and it's certainly one of the best TV shows ever made. You know, from the direction to the writing to all of the amazing acting in the show. I mean, there's really nothing like it that I can point to. As someone who works in a in the computer industry, I can tell you that all of the actual, you know, computer stuff that they do in the film, it's all real, it's all plausible. You know, it can all be done. And if you wanted to do what the people in this show are trying to do, then the way that they go about doing it would be the way that you would want to do it. I mean, Rami Malek, this show has really been sort of a revelation for him as an actor. I've seen him in other sort of small bit parts or character parts, like in The Master. He played a member of Philip Seymour Hoffman's cult, but he really wasn't given anything to do. A movie or a TV show rather like this really allows him to stretch sort of his acting muscles, and he's really come forth out of it as a major talent. Christian Slater is also really, really great in this movie, or I keep saying movie, in this TV show. His dynamic with the main character Elliot is really great. He has a lot of really great sort of monologues and speeches. He's an excellent character. The psychological aspects of it are fascinating. You know, all of the sort of pontificating about society and all of that's fascinating. It really is a special kind of movie that doesn't come around a lot. Why do I keep saying movie? A special kind of TV show that does not come around a lot. And if you haven't watched it, you definitely should. And then obviously the next thing that I have on my shelf is the second season of Mr. Robot, where, you know, it really does everything that a follow-up should do as far as, you know, what your job is going out, whether it's a sequel to a movie or a second season of a TV show. You know, your job is to take what you established and expand upon it and make it better. It's exactly what they've done with Mr. Robot Season 2. You know, there's one hell of a twist in there that I never would have expected at all. It's a fascinating. I mean, Season 2 really has less to do with technology and more to do with Elliot's character. And all of the character study that they do in season two of Elliot is all very fascinating. He has continued to evolve as a very interesting character to sort of watch and try and decipher. Excuse me. The next movie is The Neon Demon, which is another Nicholas Winding Refn film. It's his newest one. Oh, I keep burping here. It's his newest movie. And it's certainly, I think, one of his most fascinating, from the sense that I have never seen a movie quite like The Neon Demon. It's really difficult for me to find the words to accurately express, like, what the movie it's a very clear satire of the modeling industry, okay? It's a really, really gruesome, graphic film as well. I mean, the ending is, if you're squeamish, the ending is very graphic, and not for the faint of heart. But it's also a fascinating look at just how cutthroat a high stakes business like modeling can be. I mean, obviously in real life models don't go to the extent of what they do in the film, but it is a fascinating, you know, examination of what someone would theoretically be willing to do if circumstances gave them an opportunity to. And I mean, everyone in the movie is really good. Elle Fanning has in the past couple of years really revealed herself as a great actress. Keanu Reeves has a very interesting and very well done, bit part in this film. All the rest of the girls who play the models are really good. Once again, Nicholas Winding Refn's use of color and cinematography is great. No Ryan Gosling, unfortunately. Like the last two movies he did before in the end, even, but it is still a good movie, nonetheless. Not for everybody. You can probably apply that statement to basically anything that Nicholas Winding Refn has done. I mean, I haven't seen all of his movies, but I have seen Drive, Only God Forgives, Neon Demon, Valhalla Rising, and parts of Bronson. But yeah, I mean, his work is not for everybody. That's for sure. Next up is one of my favorite movies from last year, and that is The Nice Guys. The Nice Guys is a great contemporary buddy cop movie where that genre sort of died after Kevin Smith made his buddy cop movie Cop Out, which was a dumpster fire. Ever since then, that movie actually almost single-handedly killed the buddy cop movies up until The Nice Guys, because hey Google, when did Cop Out get released?
Came out in the United States of America on February 26, 2010.
Yeah, there's not a buddy cop movie that I can think of that was released in the past 7 years or in the past 6 years before The Nice Guys. So, it's not a genre that many people do anymore, but one of the people who really can do it is Shane Black. I mean, he probably has a better understanding of the genre than anybody else. I mean, from his work on Lethal Weapon, to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, to this, to he really he if there's someone who understands that genre, it's definitely him. And there's a reason why he can really understand it, because he can make a good buddy cop film. So yeah, The Nice Guys, if you haven't seen it, it's hilariously funny. It's got a really unconventional story too. Like I've never really seen a movie before that deals with a murder in the porn industry. It's interesting. It really is, and it's got a great performance from Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, and Ryan Gosling's daughter in the movie. I don't know the actress's name who plays his daughter, but she's also very, very good for a child actress. Next up is Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal. That was a movie that I was also extremely hyped for. I believe in 2015 was when that came out. I don't think it was last year. I think it was 2 years ago. Jake Gyllenhaal had a real has had, I should say, because it hasn't really, I can't really think of anything that has ended it, has had a really great and impressive run of just great feature films. He did Nightcrawler, he did Life this year, which I thought was great. He's doing a movie called Stronger that looks good. There's Southpaw, that was good. If you just scroll through his recent Nocturnal Animals, rather, fantastic movie that I intend to own, but I don't have it yet. He's just had a sort of a string of movies lately that have all been really, really great, and Nightcrawler was one of the early ones. I'm a really big fan of any movie, that has to do with sort of the dirty side of the news industry. Whether it's newspapers, like in Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole, or with TV, like broadcast news, or like network. Because I think that it's something that we all deep down know inside, that these industries are probably pretty corrupt, but we don't really care, or just sort of turn a blind eye to it, or don't sort of recognize in ourselves that we know that. And so whenever it's either satirized or played up to an extent, like in Nightcrawler, it always tends to be a fascinating movie, I should say. Obviously, I'm sure that there's some that have failed. I know that there was a movie that came out called Christine that came out either last year or very early this year that had Rebecca Hall in it as the title character. And that was a movie that was also about the failures of the news industry, but I haven't actually seen yet, so I don't know if that one's good. It seems like it has a good performance in it from Rebecca Hall, and Rebecca Hall is a great actress. But yeah, Nightcrawler is it's unconventional subject matter, like, as far as I'm aware. you know, outside of the connection to sort of the Dirty News business, I'm not aware of any other movie that's come out that has to do with the people who shoot footage for murder stories on the news. So that part of it's also interesting, is, you know, it's not something that I think many people know about. I certainly didn't think that they were just, before this movie came out, I should say, I didn't know that a lot of news stations just bought footage from amateur photographers. I figured that anything you saw on the news was captured by people who worked for whatever station was airing it, or was shared between stations. But night crawling is a real industry, and they do some fascinating stuff with it in the movie, and it's got a great central performance from Jake Gyllenhaal. I don't know how he didn't get nominated for an Oscar for it. Massive, massive snub there. But yeah, if you didn't see Nightcrawler, I'd be surprised, because I'm pretty sure it got all sorts of great press. If you haven't, you should definitely check it out. Next one is a classic that pretty much everyone has seen. I should say modern classic, because it's not that old. And that's No Country for Old Men. Really one of the best Coen Brothers movies, obviously. It won Best Picture, won Best Supporting Actor, Best Directing, Best Writing. It's a fantastic movie. I think one of the last successful Miramax movies, too, before Miramax sort of, I don't know if they went under or if they just stopped making movies, but they don't seem to do anything nowadays. Maybe they just moved to TV. I honestly don't know. But No Country for Old Men, like I said, I mean, what can you really say about the movie that hasn't already been said? Because I think everybody has seen it. But yeah, No Country for Old Men is a movie that is very, very unconventional in its subject matter, and it's probably due to, you know, the fact that it's based off of a Cormac McCarthy book, and Cormac McCarthy doesn't really do anything in a conventional manner either. You know, his stories are very much, I think someone once described Cormac McCarthy's writing as masculine, and he's really the only masculine writer who's ever existed, and I would probably tend to agree with that. No Country for Old Men is ostensibly just a movie about a guy who ends up with money, and somebody wants the money that, you know, doesn't mind killing him for it. But like, it's more or less a story about like age and getting to a point in your life where things are unrecognizable to you. And while the central sort of conflict to the movie is the chase between Anton Chigurh and, I don't remember the name of the character that Josh Brolin played, while that is sort of the central point of the movie, the central point of the movie really has more to do with Tommy Lee Jones, where he's just gotten to a point where he's gotten older to where he no longer understands criminals. And he no longer thinks that he has the ability to sort of track them down and chase them down in the same way that he did when he was younger, because he doesn't get why things have escalated to such a point that they have. And that's obviously all punctuated by his dream at the end, where he's basically saying that, you know, he has now done the exact same thing that his father has done, and now his father is waiting for him. It's a great movie. It's got some extremely tense scenes, some great performances by pretty much everybody involved, some really interesting things from the standpoint of sort of morality and moral questions, and the questions that the movie has on its mind are very interesting questions that not many movies sort of explore. So it's certainly one that's worth watching. Next up is Oblivion. This was one from Tom Cruise's sci-fi duology, I like to say, when he did Oblivion, and then right after that he did Edge of Tomorrow, where he did these two sort of lower-budgeted sci-fi movies. I'm sorry, where they were lower-budgeted, like, they didn't have the pull behind them like Mission Impossible has, for example, but I find Oblivion to be a very good movie. Once again, certainly a aspect of sci-fi that has been done before. It does have some familiarity with Moon, with some of its conflicts towards its main character and things like that, but it's just an interesting story, and it's got some really great camera work. The landscape looks very interesting. The tech that Tom Cruise and his sort of wife character use, those are very interesting. The story's got some twists and turns to it. It's just a fun movie, and you know, it doesn't seem to go for any sort of extremely high highs at all. But at the same time, what it does execute, it executes to great effect and very successfully. And I know that when I first saw the movie, when the big reveal sort of made around the hour and a half mark, I was very intrigued, and very, very shocked. There's a bit of a twist to it that's interesting. And a great Blu-ray transfer as well. That was really the first ever Blu-ray that I had. It's not the first Blu-ray that I had. The first Blu-ray that I had was actually Dread, but it was the first Blu-ray that I had where I really noticed the quality of the image. Next up here is Ocean's 11. Not my favorite Ocean's movie. My favorite Ocean's movie is Ocean's 13, which, funny enough, I don't actually own. The only one I do own is Ocean's 11. I gotta see if I can still find that in a store, otherwise I'm gonna have to order it. But I just love the Ocean's movies. It's got, like, one of my favorite things in the world, which is that really sort of snappy, biting dialogue, almost like an Aaron Sorkin script. But I don't actually know. Hey, Google. Who wrote Ocean's 11?
Ocean's 11 screenwriter was Ted Griffin.
Okay, whoever Ted Griffin is did a really great job with this, and I'm assuming he also was the screenwriter for the ones after it. You know, it's also a Steven Soderbergh movie, so all of the direction is great. The colors of Las Vegas and in the casinos are really great. The heist and its sort of cast of characters are all diverse and very interesting. You know, it's sort of one of the original, let's put together this team to pull off a heist movies. Obviously those have been done, you know, again and again nowadays, but I do think that sort of Ocean's 11 is sort of the original one. I can't really think of, any older movies where in the same sense you had this sort of large cast of character. Obviously Ocean's 11 is a remake of a Frank Sinatra movie, but as far as I'm aware, from the Frank Sinatra version and from movies of that sort of time period, they didn't do a whole lot of heist movies where it was a gang of different and interesting people in different ways that sort of got together with all of these interesting personalities to try and pull off a heist. You know, now that's done all the time, but I would say that Ocean's 11, it was probably the prototype for it, and it's still the best, which is funny. I don't think anyone's ever really managed to do better than Ocean's 11 as far as that kind of a story is concerned. But yeah, again, probably a movie you've already seen. It's got a fantastic cast. I mean, you got George Clooney, you got Brad Pitt, you got Matt Damon, you got Bernie Mac, you got Don Cheadle, you got Casey Affleck, you got Scott Caan. What's his name? Andy Garcia, Julia Roberts. I mean, it's a great cast, and all of them play off each other really, really well, and all of them are funny, and the story, there's very little that you could say wrong about the Ocean's movies. Ocean's 12, I don't think is such a good movie, because it just doesn't, it doesn't feel like the other two movies. Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 13 are both really great, and they're both sort of similar to one another as far as what they do, but I don't know. There's something about Ocean's 12 that's just weird to me. It just doesn't really necessarily feel like an Ocean's movie. It's almost like they almost got like more into the, as weird as it sounds, the world building. Because in the Ocean's movies, there's almost sort of like this unspoken, like, rules to being a thief. Like there's a code amongst, like, the one of the things that I can think of that comes up a couple of times is that, you know, they have this thing where there's a code amongst people who shook Sinatra's hand, which is obviously a reference to the old Sinatra movie, but then these old famous thieves and everything, there's almost like this very subtle world-building element to it that's really great, and it's almost like Ocean's 12 took that and went too far with it, kind of like how John Wick 2 did to a little bit of an extent as well. But Ocean's 11 and 13 are fantastic movies. I prefer 13 to 11, but 11 is good just the same. Next movie that I've got here is Only God Forgives. Once again, a Nicholas Winding Refn movie. Another movie that the first time I saw it, I wasn't really sure what to make of it. It's a very strange movie, as far as its storyline, you know, as far as what the performances in it, what Winding Refn is trying to do isn't always 100% clear, but it's a very interesting film. That's the best way that I can really describe it, because there's not an elegant way to describe Only God Forgives. It's because it's essentially just a movie about a guy who is looking for forgiveness in the wrong places for something that he did. And obviously the title suggests that the only way that he can find that forgiveness is through God. And the film is basically about him being put in front of God, realizing that he is not more powerful than God, and then giving up his sins to God for forgiveness. That's essentially what the film is about. But it does that in an extremely unconventional and an extremely violent way. Nicholas Winding Refn is a very violent film director. The films that he presents... there was an article that I actually wrote not too long ago about ultraviolent movies. So ultraviolent movies like Dread, Straw Dogs, The Wild Bunch to a lesser extent, obviously, just because of the time period, you know, the ultraviolence of The Wild Bunch doesn't hold up quite as well. There are ultraviolent movies, and then there are sort of what I like to just call violent movies. Ultraviolent movies are where the blood and the gore is kicked up to such a high notch that it almost becomes hyper-realistic, to where your mind realizes, okay, this literally is impossible to happen in real life. I shouldn't take this too seriously. And then there are movies that very specific... So, like, the Quentin Tarantino is a great example of ultraviolence, because anybody who knows anything about the human anatomy understands that there's not that much blood in a human being if you get shot with a cowboy revolver.
Right.
The amount of blood that explodes out of people's bodies in a Tarantino movie is not realistic at all. But in Winding Refn's movies, all of the violence is very realistic, to the point where there are some parts of it that I could very easily see people feeling uncomfortable with watching. You know, when you see somebody get, like, cut open in their chest, and then you can see, like, their rib cage and stuff in a movie, that can be very disconcerting because of the level of violence that is in it, and to the extent that it is realistic. What Winding Refn often says about his films is that violence is very similar to sex, in that it's not about the end, it's not about the orgasm, it's about the build up to that, right? And so the movie has a lot of build-up to these explosions of violence that seem very, very cruel, and I can very easily see people having a hard time watching it. But, you know, it's an interesting period in Ryan Gosling's career. He's got three movies that he did all around the same point in his career that made him my favorite actor for his ability to select interesting roles, but... He did The Place Beyond the Pines, Only God Forgives, and Drive, and all three of those movies. I don't own Place Beyond the Pines, unfortunately, but I own Only God Forgives and Drive, and all of those are very interesting movies about the human condition. You know, Only God Forgives is a story about forgiveness for past mistakes. Drive is very much a story about attempting to change, you know, your own nature, and Place Beyond the Pines is very much an analysis piece on fathers and sons. And so... You know, all three of those movies, I think, are very, very interesting, and they're all done by interesting filmmakers, two by Refn and one by a guy named Derek Cianfrance. And Gosling gives very, very dedicated and very, very interesting performances in all of them, and they're all very, very different. I mean, the character in Drive, while he doesn't talk a whole lot, the character in Only God Forgives almost never talks. You know, I think that maybe Gosling has seven lines in the movie. I think it's to give the viewer almost a sense of seeing the situation as it unfolds through the eyes of the character themselves. So, you know, when you have a character who doesn't talk a whole lot and who instead just sort of takes in their surroundings and just sort of sees things in the same way as the audience does and doesn't give the audience a way or a filter rather to interpret those events, then you end up sort of making up your own opinions about things. So, you know, if you have a character say that guy is bad, or that guy is a villain, or what that guy just did is bad, it's going to inform to the audience in no uncertain terms of how they're supposed to feel about something. And there's almost none of that in this movie. It's outside of reading the subtext of the fact that this is a guy who's looking for forgiveness over what he's done in his past, which we do learn about. Winding Refn gives us no other filter with which to view the film, as in, are these bad people? Are these good people? Are these actions bad? Are these actions good? It's essentially all up to the audience. And that's one of the things that I very much like when, you know, when the morals behind something are not clearly established and it's left to the audience to make a decision about what they think is going on. Because, you know, that then gives each and every single person a different interpretation of something and a different experience when enjoying it. So it's a very interesting film. It's certainly not for everybody, just like the Neon Demon and Drive, but you know, for God's sake, someone sued Nicholas Winding Refn over Drive because it wasn't close enough to Fast and Furious 8. I think she was trying to sue him for, not Fast and Furious 8, just the Fast and Furious franchise. I think she was trying to sue him for false advertising. So, you know, yeah, his movies are not for everybody. So, you know, if you do watch it, I recommend watching it once, waiting a couple of days or weeks or months, and then watching it a second time. I know I got a lot more out of Only God Forgives the second time than I did the first time. The first time, you're sort of, because of the fact that, like I mentioned, there's no context for anything, you're sort of just left there to sort of experience the events happening on screen, and that's it. It's fascinating. But, yeah, it's hard to wrap up on a movie that you don't really know best how to sort of explain to the audience. The next movie that I've got here on the shelf is actually a movie that is one of my sort of underrated titles, where a lot of people hated the movie for some reason, and I can't explain why. Like, King Arthur is a movie that everyone seemed to hate. I couldn't tell you why. Ghost in the Shell was a movie that everyone seemed to hate. Couldn't tell you why. And this is another one. Pain and Gain from Michael Bay was a movie that got hated on profusely. Did very bad with the critics, very, as far as I'm aware, did really bad with the audiences as well. I thought it was hilarious. It's certainly a Michael Bay movie, and there's a very interesting, if you guys are sort of interested in the craft of filmmaking, which, you know, I would think that you guys are, considering that you actually listen to this, and as this podcast has gone on, we've gone more and more into sort of the craft of filmmaking and how films work and what does work and what doesn't, and making a good piece of art. But with Pain and Gain specifically, it's very much a Michael Bay movie. And I would encourage you guys to look up a paper that someone wrote. And I for the life of me, can't remember the name of the actual paper, but it was essentially a paper that was espousing the idea that the only cinematic auteur that exists is actually Michael Bay, which is sort of an interesting statement to make, because most of Michael Bay movies are not very good. I would say that the first Transformers movie is good. I would say Pain and Gain is good. I would say 13 Hours is all right. And most people would say that The Rock and Armageddon are good movies. I have not seen either of them in their entirety, so I can't say whether they are or not. But one of the definitions of the word auteur, other than sort of, a lot of people I think just simply interpret the word auteur to mean the best at their craft, right? Which technically that is the definition of. But what this definition that this guy is using is more pointing towards is the best at their own individual, at their own individual version of a craft. So the best way that I can explain it is that, let's say that Vincent van Gogh was an auteur at painting, which I think that probably is not an unpopular opinion. He's a great painter. He's certainly my favorite painter. But basically, the idea would be that Vincent Van Gogh did not obtain auteur status until he was doing his own type of painting at the best possible height of his abilities. So when he first started out, he couldn't quite get shapes down right, couldn't quite get colors, couldn't quite express what he was doing. But then by the time that he does Starry Night and he does the portrait of a terrace at nighttime was what it was called, which is my favorite piece by him. He has achieved auteur status where he has perfected his own personal style of doing something. And what this paper is saying is that Michael Bay is the only cinematic auteur in that if you take a frame, just one frame from a Steven Spielberg movie, any of his filmography, you probably won't be able to tell what the movie is, or more importantly, what the or who the director was, I should say. And his theory was that if you took one frame from any Michael Bay movie, you would know who directed the film. I think his parameters were Pearl Harbor onwards, because I believe the movies he did before Pearl Harbor were just Armageddon and The Rock. And then he did Pearl Harbor, the Transformers movies, Pain and Gain, 13 Hours. Basically his point was that if you take any frame from any of those movies, you're going to be able to recognize it as a Michael Bay movie. That Michael Bay has sort of perfected his own craft, which there are some people who I would say, who would say that that's a bad thing, in that if all of your movies look the same or sound the same or shot the same, then you lose a certain aspect of what making movies is, in that you should be flexible, or that you should be, or that you should have the ability to sort of do things differently. I mean, obviously, as far as someone like Edgar Wright is concerned, he can do multiple genres very well, from comedy to action to drama. He can do all of that very well. Whereas with Michael Bay, he pretty much does action comedy. He really doesn't do anything else. And so there are some people who would say that that's a bad thing. I wouldn't necessarily say that it is a bad thing. I would say it's probably a bad thing if you have a cemented style and you try to do something else that style doesn't work for. So like a Michael Bay movie would not work for like a soap opera type of a storyline about, you know, like cheating on each other things like that. But it does work for an action movie. And then of course you have other people who are saying that if the notable aspects of your film are the directorial style, then there's probably no actual substance to the film that is meritable. And I would say that that's a much better argument against sort of what Michael Bay does. But at the same time, I don't think that Michael Bay has any illusions that what he's making is high art. If he does, then I certainly feel sorry for him, because nobody else thinks that. But Pain and Gain is I think it's probably his best movie that I have personally seen. It's funny. The characters are interesting, and it's sometimes relatable. The story is outlandish and crazy, and also funny. It's a movie that I don't think anything else like it exists. I mean, I can't tell you any other movie that has it's sort of its story cranked up so high to like 11, and has, you know, such crazy sort of unhinged performances from pretty much everybody involved. I can't really think of any other movie like it. I think it's the perfect kind of movie that suits Michael Bay's style extremely well, and I think that's why it works so well. But yeah, I think that at this point, Michael Bay's name is just sort of cinematic poison, where even if he did something very good, it would probably still get panned by critics just because it's Michael Bay, and they'd probably want him out of the industry for some of the things that he has made that have overall, I guess, in their minds, lowered the IQ of the film industry. But I like Pain and Gain quite a lot. I think it's a hilarious movie. I always enjoy watching it every time. I show it to my friends, and they love it as well. And it's a very quotable movie as well, as far as a lot of the jokes are concerned. Very, very, it's very underrated. Next up is one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's best movies from the 1980s. This is Predator. Predator is a movie that is it's impressive for the time as far as like the special effects and as far as how they shot the movie and the locations that they use. All of that is actually very, very impressive for the time that it was made in. I mean, obviously, Arnold did a he did quite a few action movies in the 1980s and into the 90s, and then he became a governor of California, and so then he was not in movies for a while, and I believe his return to movies was was The Expendables 2, where he, I mean, he had one scene in The Expendables 1, but evidently his proper return to movies was in The Expendables 2. But Predator and Terminator, and Terminator 2 are really, like, the three movies that came out of that era that are, like, really genuinely great movies that he's in. I know a lot of people will add to that list, like, Commando and, there's another, like, The Running Man. Oh, and, Total Recall. Like, he was in a lot of movies, but a lot of them were pretty bad. But I would say that the four major ones are Total Recall, Terminator 1, Terminator 2, and Predator, and then the extended list would include Commando and The Running Man. But yeah, he was in a lot of garbage. But Predator was a very impressive movie for special effects when it was made. It's a movie that's still very quotable and a lot of fun to watch today. It's unfortunate that it was combined with the Alien universe because they don't feel like the same thing at all. Although, because of Alien Covenant, that whole continuity with Alien versus Predator doesn't work anymore. So I'm totally happy now that those two things have been made separate. Because outside of, like, Predator and Predators, there has not been anything good involving a Predator. Like, the Alien versus Predator movies were not good. Predator 2 was terrible. And Predators was pretty fun. But yeah, Predator, the original, it's classic Schwarzenegger, just a bunch of yoked-out dudes going in to kick some ass, and they end up having to kill an animal. It's just a lot of fun. There's not much else you can really say about Predator. It doesn't really try to do anything other than just be a fun movie. And it certainly does that well enough. Next up, we have another movie that is, once again, cerebral sci-fi. Once again, underrated sci-fi in the sense that not enough people have seen it. It's based off of a short story by Robert A. Heinlein, which anybody who who does a lot of reading, especially of science fiction reading, will recognize that name. He wrote Starship Troopers, which became a movie. He wrote The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, he wrote, which is a terrible book, by the way. Do not read it. He's most famous for the book Stranger in a Strange Land. He's a classic sci-fi author. And this was based off of a short story. And Predestination is a fantastic movie. Very, very interesting narrative. I can't think of any other movie that's like Predestination. As far as the story that it's trying to tell, its use of time travel, what the time travel is used for. I mean, the performances by Ethan Hawke and Sarah Snook are both really, really great. I'm not aware of who... Hey, Google. Who directed the movie Predestination?
Predestination was directed by Peter Spierig and Michael Spierig.
Okay, I'm not aware of those two filmmakers at all, other than Predestination now. So I don't know if they've done anything else, but I would certainly be curious to see what else they direct, because Predestination is a extremely unique movie. It's an extremely fascinating movie. It's got, like I mentioned, great performances in it. Very unconventional, very smart. And the emotion in the movie is all super present. You know, they don't skimp out on anything. It's a hell of a movie. It really is. You should certainly watch it because it's not a movie that you really have to sit down and think about and wrap your head around, like something like Only God Forgives. It's a complex movie, but everything is explained to you in the film. Not from a sense of, you know, exposition, but through just watching it, you will understand the movie. In the same way that, like the movie Cloud Atlas, which is another movie I actually quite enjoy. I don't own it, but I did quite enjoy watching it. That is a movie that is about interconnection, where different people's sort of stories and paths cross one another. I think one of the lines that one of the characters says is that that through different lives and through different time periods, our paths cross, like figure skaters, and the way that they cue the audience in to the paths crossing, which I thought was extremely interesting, was that they had the actors play a bunch of different roles. So anytime sort of the paths between two sort of spirits or souls or whatever, the movie was connecting the characters through across like sort of time and space, it would be the same actor, but they would have makeup in a certain way or a certain outfit, or their voice would be different, something like that. And all of that was, it was genuinely fascinating to see sort of, oh, that's that person, and oh, that's that person. It leads you down a series of discoveries as the film goes by, and the same thing is the case for Predestination, is that as the film continues and goes on, you will discover sort of the reality of the situation and what is happening, and what you're watching, and it's fascinating, it's extremely smart, and it's just it's a great movie. Yeah, Predestination is certainly one that you guys should look for. It was very hard to find on a Blu-ray. I think that my local Best Buy had like 3 copies of it when it came out, so I you probably have to go online to buy it, but I'm sure that you can rent it or watch it online someplace, certainly. Next up is Prometheus, the Ridley Scott return to the Alien series. He's now directed 3 Alien movies. For those of you who don't know, it goes Prometheus, Alien Covenant, Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, and then Alien Resurrection. Alien Resurrection is literally a pile of garbage. Alien 3 is just real uneven. It's not a terrible movie, but it's not a very good movie. Aliens is basically Alien redone with Space Marines. Alien is one of the greatest movies of all time. Alien Covenant is a very fascinating movie on based on humanity, and Prometheus is in that same exact vein. and the 3 Alien movies that Ridley Scott has now made, I all find very fascinating. And Prometheus was, it seems to me that now that, you know, with time and with retrospect, Prometheus seems to be the studio letting Ridley Scott make whatever they want to make, whereas Alien Covenant was, okay, we'll let you make whatever you want to make as long as you include X, Y, and Z. And what I mentioned in my review of the movie, Alien Covenant, early this year, is I talked a lot about how the scenes with the actual sort of fully formed xenomorph towards the end of the film, they feel tacked on. They feel unnecessary for the actual film, and that the film that he wanted to tell was in line with Prometheus, where it's about consciousness and humanity, and, you know, autonomy and creation and things to that nature. So all of the scenes in Alien Covenant and Prometheus that are involving David, this sort of semi-psychotic android, are all extremely fascinating. The scenes where sort of in Prometheus where David starts to interact with other humans and run these experiments, and he discovers that he has an interest for creating new things and combining things to see what happens. All of that is extremely fascinating in Prometheus, and all of the performances in Prometheus are extremely good. From the pilot played by Idris Elba to Michael Fassbender's performance as David to Noomi, I believe is how you pronounce her first name, Noomi Rapace as Elizabeth Shaw, Charlize Theron. It's a very, very interesting science fiction story. That's really what it is at the end of the day. It's effectively just a movie about what would happen if you went to go meet your creator, and things did not turn out the way that you had expected them to. You know, that you're not going to get the answers that you're looking for by meeting your creator. It's, again, it's another movie that I can't really think of anything else that's similar to it. I think it gets a lot of crap, that is unnecessary. I'm not exactly sure what the backlash to this movie was, because a lot of the issues that I think people bring up, a lot of the nitpicks that people bring up as being flaws of the film are very easily explained if you just pay attention. I mean, you can take the scene where the two guys get lost from the storm, where they can't get back to the ship in time, and he was the one who had mapped the caves. Well, he doesn't have access to the entirety of the map, right? But everyone kept talking about the fact that he just mapped it. How did he get lost? But the map that's being mapped is being sent to the ship. So if the ship can't communicate with him, then he's not going to be able to make his way around the inside of the place. So I think that there was a lot of flaws of the movie that people pointed out that weren't actually flaws. You know, which was, seems like a nonsensical statement, but so were a lot of the reviews for the movie, much like King Arthur, which a lot of you guys enjoyed my in-depth review of the movie Whiplash, and I think that because of the fact that so many people think King Arthur is a bad movie, I think I'm going to throw that one into the old Blu-ray player here one of these days and do an in-depth commentary on King Arthur, because it's a movie that deserves so much more credit than it gets, and it's certainly one of the best movies of 2017 so far, and that's saying a lot considering that 2017 has been an inordinately fantastic year for movies. but yeah, look for that, you guys. My review of King Arthur, or I should say my commentary of King Arthur. We did a Dudes on Film for it, but anyone who listens to Dudes on Film knows that we rarely talk about the actual movie. We tend to talk about things other than the movie, and it just sort of becomes like a podcast where the two of us are just hanging out watching a movie. But yeah, in the same vein as King Arthur, Prometheus is a movie that a lot of people had problems with, and I don't know why, because I think that the movie's pretty great. And some amazing special effects in that movie. I mean, some of the best special effects I've ever seen, even to this day, where the movie is a handful of years old, I believe it came out in 2011, it still stands up extremely well to today. And that one is also a movie that deserves a 4K transfer. I have not seen that happen yet. But yeah, Prometheus, I'm sure that probably if you listen to this podcast and you're interested in a lot of the same things that I am, that you've probably seen it, but it is a good movie. Do not believe all of the people who sort of bring up random crap about it and try and use that as justification for it being bad. The next movie is actually one of it was my favorite movie for a really long time. Before I started like watching a lot of movies and sort of getting really deep into the art of filmmaking and the craft of filmmaking, it was actually my favorite movie. And this is Public Enemies. The Michael Mann 1930s gangster flick with Johnny Depp. It's a really interesting character study of John Dillinger as a man. And I live in Wisconsin, which was one of the famous areas that John Dillinger was in, and places that he robbed are here, and the place that he hid out, Little Bohemia, that's up in northern Wisconsin. So and they filmed a lot of the movie in Wisconsin as well. So you can go to a lot of the places where they actually filmed, and I think that one of the places where they actually filmed the movie, they still have a lot of the cobblestones that they laid down intact, and then I know that a lot of the stores on that main avenue kept the window painting that was done for the background sets of the film, because they filmed on location. Like you should film outside, not on in front of a green screen. But I think it's a good movie. It's a movie that I think is a lot more interested in sort of who he was as a man, rather than just showing you sort of bank robberies. There are obviously bank robberies in the movie, but they really take second place to who he was as a man, and then specifically sort of second place to the relationship between him and Marion Cotillard's character that she plays. I don't remember her name. But the relationship between the two of them is really what sort of drives the story forward, and you really get the sense that they were two people who really cared for each other, and in the same way as sort of Nicholas Ray's movies like In a Lonely Place or Rebel Without a Cause, or he's got another movie that's also released on Criterion that the name of I can't remember right now. They Live by Night. In the same way, this is a movie about two sort of outsiders who find solace with one another and sort of want to spend their life together. So it's a really, really good movie. And it's got a really great sort of background performance from Christian Bale as the sort of lead investigator that's looking for him. It's got some really great set pieces and some good action in it. But Public Enemies is just it's a fun movie. When it wants to be, but it's also a serious and affecting movie when it wants to be as well. I don't think it was one of Michael Mann's better received movies. A lot of critics have a strange relationship with Michael Mann, where they'll give his work sort of top marks, and then like sort of the next movie that he releases, they'll utterly destroy, like with Black Hat. But Public Enemies is it's it was one of my it was my favorite movie for a while, and it's still a really enjoyable movie to watch even to this day. The next movies I should say, because it's a box set. I have the Raid collection, which has the Raid 2, Redemption and the Raid 2 in it, and it's a duology of films that are just shameless action movies. It doesn't give you any reason to sort of care about the characters or what's happening on screen, and it doesn't care that you don't care, because what it really wants to do is just show you some incredible action. And the fight scene in the kitchen in Raid 2 is one of the best action scenes that has ever been on film. I would challenge you to find a better fight scene in the kitchen fight in Raid 2. Because that is just two guys who really understand choreography and fighting, and they make that fight so excellent, and super well choreographed. And to sort of explain, you know, why choreography is important and why effective choreography is important, is that it isn't just enough to know. One of my friends very comedically said that choreography, if you want to really break it down as far as the definition, is that everybody knows where everybody is. And that's effectively exactly correct, in that when you choreograph a sequence, you have to stand this place, you have to move to this place, you have to hit this place, you have to go that place. One of the main problems is that if you don't have effective choreography on its own, is not just knowing sort of the movements and where to go and what to say and how to throw the fist and everything. Because if you just have that, you know, behind you, then you end up with scenes like the final lightsaber duel between Anakin and Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars Episode 3, where the main sort of complaint with that is that, in theory, that fight scene should have been sort of a masterful execution of choreography on screen. But the problem was that it ended up looking so over-practiced that you were just reminded of the fact that this is a choreographed series of movements, and then you were immediately taken out of the situation, and you were just watching a series of choreography movements, and then, you know, there was no more tension. The tension was killed by that. Whereas with the Raid 2, with that fight scene in the kitchen, in order to properly execute that fight scene in the kitchen, you have to have amazing choreography, but it is not over-practiced and overburdened by the fact that it no longer feels like there are no stakes. The stakes are perfectly clear. There's enough choreography and understanding of what the fight is supposed to be by the actors that, you know, you can make it look effective, but at the same time, they also understand martial arts to a great degree. So, as a result, you end up with these great fight scenes where, you know, a lot of movies that go for those great fight scenes don't necessarily hit the marks because it's either over-choreographed or they just don't have the right experts or whatever it might be. But, you know, just as far as martial arts movies are concerned, and action movies are concerned, in the past couple of years, there hasn't been anything that's been better than The Raid and The Raid 2. It's fantastic. You know, everything in them is fantastic, other than sort of the fact that, of course, you're not really meant to care about anything other than the fighting, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that, but that would, if there was any drawback that anyone could have towards the Raid movies, then it would certainly be that. I don't think it's a problem. I think most people who have seen them don't think it's a problem. And the guy who directed it, or directed both of them, I can't remember what his... Gareth Evans. Gareth Evans is the director. He is a real promising... he's a real promising sort of director, because in the Raid 2, he sort of perfects a style that he set out for in the Raid 1, where the Raid 1 is, it's got the same great action as there, but some of the moments can be a bit too shaky as far as the camera's concerned, whereas in the Raid 2, a lot of it, a lot of that camera shake that's unnecessary is removed, and so you can really accurately sort of see everything. Camera flourishes are improved, so he does. I mean, in his filmography for the future on IMDb, I think that the only thing he really has in there is the Raid 3, but I'm very interested to see him do something other than The Raid, to see how sort of his experience making these just excellent action movies sort of translates to something else. He's certainly a director to watch. He certainly should sort of go check out anything that he does, at least for the foreseeable future. It's certainly possible that, you know, as time goes on, he may not have, you know, talent to do anything other than action movies, but at the very least, The Raid and The Raid 2 are two fantastic movies, and I certainly recommend it if you're interested in seeing really good fight choreography and what a really effective action movie can be. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I got for you guys for this week. We got through the rest of that cube, so we're down to sort of only one and a half here before we get into the Criterion movies. And, I mean, each of the Criterion movies I would be able to talk about for a really long time, because there's obviously a bevy of reasons why they're A, in the Criterion collection, then B, why I have them. But I hope you guys sort of got some new movies to watch as far as from the recommendations, or some new TV. If you haven't seen Mr. Robot, you should definitely watch that. And I will see you all next week. Have a good one.